Good evening and welcome to the regular meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board for the City of Morro Bay. It is 6 p.m. on Thursday, October 3rd, 2013. This meeting is now called to order. Please let the record show that we have established quorum. Six members are present. We'll start the meeting with a moment of silence, please. Thank you, and we'll now have our Pledge of Allegiance. Please rise.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, and we'll now move on to Chair and Advisory Board Member announcements and presentations. We will start on my left, down with Gene. Any announcements?
Nope.
Bill.
None.
Lynn.
None here.
Dana. Well, I'm the only guy tonight. Well, I have two announcements. One is with regard to an event that the Morro Bay Community Foundation puts on annually, and it's called Morro Bay Sings. This is a little advance notice. It's still a little over a month away. But Morro Bay Sings this year is featuring Elvis Presley. So there are going to be three singers that will be putting on the performance, and the date is November 9th, Saturday, November 9th. The proceeds from this event go toward helping children in our community pay for their parks and recreation fees. So I'm on the board for the Morro Bay Community Foundation. It's a great organization. And again, the cause is for kids that can't necessarily afford the fees otherwise. So it allows children to play in sports here in town and assist them financially. So if you can make that, I know you're all a fan of Elvis because we all are. You want to do that on November of next month, November 9th. One other announcement from me. We've had a lot going on in the city over the last several weeks with regard to the city council and some potential personnel issues. I just wanted to put out a message and use the microphone here for a moment and urge everyone in the community to strive toward unity, strive toward progress, look for the things that we have in common as opposed to the differences. It's a small town. And in a very real sense, we're all extended family to each other that live here. So come together as good as we can, move forward for the better of the city. Thank you. We will now move on to public comment period. Is there anyone in the audience that has a public comment for things that are not on the agenda? The way we work public comment is the same way as the council. If you'd like to make a comment on something that's on the agenda, you'll come up before that agenda item. So the public comment right now is for anything in general that you would like to speak about.
Good evening, Bill Martin, Morro Bay. I wasn't sure if Nelson Sullivan and the Shillelagh, is that on the agenda? I didn't notice it. And
That's in the Harbor status report, but you're free to
now's
speak
the
to
time.
That now. Yes.
Okay, thanks. And just a little background. We've known Nelson since the 70s. He's an old albacore fisherman. Currently, we went up and visited him a couple weeks ago. He has Alzheimer's. He's up in Monterey. His niece, Deidre, is helping out and taking care of him. He has a shillelagh, dire need to be taken care of. And I don't know if you have a copy of his niece's letter. She asked if we read it or present it to the board. If you've gotten it, I won't, you know, go through that.
You got it.
Okay, then I won't have to read that. Mainly, we just wanted to say that we're in touch with Deidre also. I know it's an issue that needs to be kind of dealt with because the shillelagh is getting a little weak and rusty, for lack of a better word. We're here. We're in touch on a boat hauling. It seems like it's been 20 years now ever since the Boatyard Shopping Center was built. So I would not let that go at this point because I think it could really fit in with a boat haul out south of the South T Pier. And then the other thought while I'm speaking is the actual South T Pier itself. I was underneath it, and I noticed it's really beefed up with steel beams and, you know, new supports and that. And another thought would be, as far as a haul out, you might even notch out the T-pier, either at the end, or if it's strong enough to actually use that to haul boats out. You know, if it's beefy enough right now, just use the T-pier, cut a notch out of it, even if it was a hinged notch that you drop it down. If a boat needs to come out, you hinge it up, bring in the boat, take the travel lift out, and just use the T-pier as far as the boat haul out. So those are two thoughts. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate your comments. Anyone else for public comment? Seeing no one else, public comment is now closed. We'll move on to the consent calendar. Item A1, the approval of minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting held on September 5th, 2013. Are there any changes or amendments to the minutes as proposed? Dana.
Just in the very first line there, Chair and Advisory Board, announcements and presentations, it says Morro Bay Yacht Club in that first sentence. It should be the Morro Bay Youth Sailing Foundation. We'll have a booth at the Harbor Festival featuring the Youth Sailathon, so that's the one correction. Small correction, but.
All right, that correction.
See what I'm talking about, Polly?
Is noted. Did you get that, Polly?
Sailing Foundation, that it benefits the Morro Bay Youth Sailing Foundation, but it actually is.
That is who it is.
Presented by.
Right.
Okay.
It's actually a different than the Yacht Club.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. That correction is noted. Any other changes, amendments, corrections? I have just one addition, Polly, on the last page, the motion. There's no notation of who that motion was moved by or seconded by. And so I think our record should reflect that. So I actually made that motion, and was it Bill who did you all remember who seconded that motion? Was it you, Bill?
Yes.
Yeah. So if you could, Bill Luffy. Any other changes or amendments? Any questions on those, Polly? Okay, great. So with those changes or amendments, I'll look for a motion to approve.
I'll make that motion.
Move to approve by Gene. A second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Dana. All in or any discussion? None? No discussion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? It passes unanimously. And our next item on the agenda is the Harbor Department status report from our Harbor Director, Eric Endersby. Eric.
Good evening, and thank you, Chair and Harbor Advisory Board. I would like to add one announcement. It's one that it's hard to not notice right now, but Harbor Festival happening this weekend. I guess we all kind of take it for granted that it occurs and everybody knows about it, but not everybody always knows about it. So this weekend, October 5th and 6th, down at the waterfront, they've moved the venue a little bit further south in terms of the north end. They've pulled it back from the very extreme north end of the Embarcadero, but for the most part, it's business as usual with lots of events, booths, music, kids' end, kids' carnival, playground as well. So I encourage everybody to come down and see that. From all looks of the weather, it looks like it's going to be maybe a little windy, you know, offshore wind, a northeasterly wind, but should be a good event this weekend. As for the status report, staff news, we recently pinned badges on our reserve Harbor Patrol officers Tim Cowan, Nate Ditmore, Marcos Green, Garrett Rose, and Kyle Schaefer for their service and training. We've historically used not made a real big deal about badge pinning with our crew, you know, just kind of done it when they earn their badges, but it's an important thing and it's a proud moment for those guys. So within our department, we did a little badge pinning and had a small ceremony within our own department. The new Harbor Patrol vessel, as you can see, hopefully you got the color version, because it's awful blue compared to our other faded boats. It's well underway. It's moved out of the dirty side of the yard, and it's over in the clean side. It's getting engines and wiring and fire pump and all the good stuff put in. Boat Bill is a little behind schedule, according to what we set out in our bid package, but most of it is moving along pretty clearly, and we do have plenty of time in working together with each other and in a friendly business manner and minding the environmental hazards and issues out there. So we meet with them once a year, and they all kind of just sit down around and have a good round table on the different issues and bring their ideas to the table as well. So it's pretty well attended. We got pretty much all the rental boat folks out there, a lot of the charter boats and those sorts of folks, so that went pretty well. And the council front, the lease sites for Rosa's Landing and Rocas were both recently approved by the city for consent of landowner, which means the city has taken a first look at their proposed development or redevelopment projects and passed judgment on them in terms of approve or disapprove, and then also authorizing staff, meaning myself and Laura, to enter negotiations to start down the lease negotiation path for a new lease or an amendment, whatever the case may be. And as far as Rosa's goes, we're bringing it to City Council this next week for, hopefully, if I can get the staff report done, for approval of the actual new lease. And the owner, Doug Reagan, has applied to the planning division to start looking at building his new project, which consists primarily of putting out 7 new slips out in front of his lease site there where there's hasn't been slips before. Rocas is a kind of a completion of an interior remodel, if you recall. Back in 2010, they were going to do a modest remodel, and then once they got into it and started tearing into the walls, they discovered that it needed a lot more than they thought, so it got a pretty complete overhaul in 2010, 2011, and they're going to complete now that project, which takes what used to be the back side of the restaurant, the water side, which really didn't have any windows or any access to the water, didn't really look out towards the water. Everything looked towards the street. They're putting restaurant space back in there, so that'll be a good change there. And some changes to the Anchor Memorial Park as well. If you're not aware, on the north side of that lease site, the walkway is maybe 3 feet wide between the park and the building. It's real tight, so we're going to widen that up and get the harbor walkway a little widened up as it leads down to the south. So those will be some good projects. Snowy Plover Fest fencing came down. Was that last week, Polly? I think it was. Snowy Plover nesting season's over. With assistance of State Park, we got all of our, most of our stuff out. We usually leave the corridor up that's down kind of at the far southern end of our city limit, down towards what's called the Carson Cove area. But for the most part, all the rest of our signage and ropes and signs and whatnot have all come down. You heard from Mr. Martini about the fishing vessel Shillelagh. It's been a tough issue to battle with. You all received an email like yesterday. While I do have known Nelson for a long time as well, and have sympathy for the plight he's in, the boat is not getting any better. It's not getting attended to, and we're taking proactive action now in case something does happen to at least minimize any pollution or other threats that may occur. Because if something doesn't happen with that boat, it is going to sink. And we're trying to work with his niece and anybody else that can help out to just try and abate some of the issues. So we're getting there. We're struggling with it. But it really needs to be dealt with one way or another. And so far it hasn't happened. So we're working on that project. We did remove, as I sent out in that email yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, almost 900 gallons of fuel and oil, other hazardous materials off the deck. We've made efforts to try and respect his private property there and remove the gear that's not just debris and junk and cat litter and all kinds of other stuff that's been left on the boat. So we're trying to run the middle line there and respect that, but then at least not have a public safety hazard as well. So that's what's going on there. And then the AIS landing craft, this one showed up when we did our dredging, when the Corps of Engineers did their dredging in 2009, 2010. AIS was the construction company that got that job, and they brought in an old landing craft as an assist vessel for that. And they've since not been able to use it anymore. I think the engines over the last couple of years don't meet the air board requirements for emissions, so they can't use them as a commercial craft anymore, so they're looking at scrapping that boat. So they've been picking away at it, taking equipment off and cutting things off and lifting them off, so hopefully that boat will go away pretty soon too, because it's not much further behind the Shillelagh in terms of condition. Coastal Cleanup Day was last Saturday, or a couple Saturdays ago, September 21st. Our role in that generally is providing trash and beach access and logistics on our beach, transport of gear, and getting folks over to the sand spit. The National Estuary Program puts together a pretty good group every year that go over and scour the sand spit. And then between us and, I think, state parks, we remove whatever trash they find over there. So that's been a pretty good event over the years. And then last on there, I guess I already preempted myself, Harbor Festival this weekend in Front Street parking lot. Still, I think, our Front Street parking lot, they had proposed earlier to go over into the Front Street parking lot with the event like they'd done years past, but safety and other street crossing issues, abating and trying to minimize public safety and pollution hazards is our primary duty. I mean, that's our main duty. That's really what we're here for, so that's what gives us our authority. And, you know, in storms, you know, other events where we need to board vessels, we generally don't, you know, Coast Guard generally plays that card when they're boarding vessels for safety inspections and for enforcement actions. We generally don't try to play that card when doing enforcement actions. If we're doing something that's requiring some kind of a boarding or a law enforcement action, most likely we're going to have the Coast Guard or the police department along with us, because if it's raised to that level, it's probably requiring more than just a casual boarding.
Bill?
Now, isn't really the whole issue about is money, in the sense is that it costs money to destroy these boats or take them out of the water, and then if the owner is unable or unwilling or you can't find them to pay for it, then we're really stuck with the bill. I mean, the bottom line, and we only have so much money to, you know, we've had grants in the past and tried to utilize that, but like in this case, you know, it could cost probably $5,000 to $10,000 to get this boat out of the water.
Yeah, I mean, and that is the big. Besides the public safety and threat to pollute, you know, how you deal with it. The state of California does have a grant program for dealing with abandoned vessels and watercraft because they recognize the need for it 10 or 12 years ago now, but it doesn't apply to commercial boats. It only applies to recreational non-documented vessels, so we can't use those grants, although we've spent probably a good $30,000 or $40,000 worth of that grant money over the last 10 years to do that. National Estuary Program, again, they gave us a grant, six, eight years ago. Pretty healthy grant to deal with, similar to the AWAF grants, to our state abandoned boat grants, to deal with commercial fishing boats, derelict commercial fishing boats. And we did get rid of a couple pretty significant boats with those grant funding, one of them being the David and Chris. It was an old trawler that Don Kubiak finally gave up on about 5 or 6 years ago, and we ended up towing it down to San Diego for a scrapper down in Ensenada to haul off. And we had a couple other boats that we ended up hauling out our launch ramp. And, yeah, it's in a best-case scenario, you know, was the Restless C2, which was an old dragger that a fellow bought that thought he was going to create a recreational boat out of, never went anywhere. We ended up lean sailing it, getting ownership. The Ships to Reef folks then kind of came around and were interested in a reef, and we had the boat. We had recently acquired it, and they were very interested in it, started pursuing the permits. Through Depths Perceptions Diving Services and some other local dive clubs and organizations, started cleaning the boat up and cleaning it out and removing the engines. And they had that boat scrubbed pretty darn clean through volunteer efforts. And it, over the years, as Ships to Reef was working on trying to get permits and the boat sat at our pier, wasn't getting any maintenance, tried to sink on us a couple times, and we finally pulled the plug on it. And Ships to Reef said, you know what, this one isn't going to work. Just because we don't have the time to get it, so we ended up demolishing it. And that was the best case scenario with a boat stripped pretty darn clean, no engine, no fuel, no anything. And it cost something north of $20,000 just to haul out and scrap. And that was because we were able to do it locally, and that was a bruiser of a haul job of, you know, 58, 60-foot boat up the launch ramp, steel boat up the launch ramp. That was a major endeavor. So, in a best case scenario, you know, it's a minimum of about $20,000. So, something that's got a lot of engines and other stuff in it, it's going to be a lot of money. So, yeah, it's a big issue. And it's tough because, you know, boats have a life, and it's not like a car where you can either tow it or put it on a trailer so easily, especially here. I mean, talking about boatyard, you know, it'd be great to pick the boat up and go put it in the back corner of the boatyard somewhere or find the back 40 to go put it on, but we just don't have that.
Hopefully we will. And I was going to make a comment, too, on my status report, but another one of Mr. Martini's comments about the vote hall. I think the city council is well aware that that may be a potential hall outside. They're looking at the Dynegy parking lot, maybe, and it is in play, and it's not something that we've forgotten about, because there is different possibilities of using that as a hall outside. So I think as we evaluate that lease proposal, that is going to be part of the conversation and how that all moves forward.
Any other questions, comments with regard to the report? Jim?
I just would like to know, it sounds kind of a bleak situation if Mr. Sullivan is not capable of giving permission and it's a documented vote and the city can't usurp the authority to do anything with it. What realistically is there as an alternative other than letting it deteriorate further till it does sink?
There is no good alternative. I mean, it's going to take, you know, even if, so until then, it's, you know, he pays his slip fees. He's keeping up on it. Typically, when boats go into that kind of state, they stop paying their fees. And then it ends up being a lien sale, and that's how we get ownership of them. In this case, he's paying his fees, and we've tried to work with his niece and with Nelson, and you know, unless she can get conservatorship or something and make the decisions and turn it over to us, you know, I can't force him to turn it over.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Yes, regarding the ownership of the boat on a documented vessel, you have to renew your documentation every year. It doesn't cost anything, but you do have to either send in or email that little form. I would rather wonder if Nelson has continued and has maintained his documentation. If he hasn't, then you don't have to worry about that particular aspect of it.
Well, yes and no. I think it has fallen out of documentation. You're right. You renew it every year. It's free through the Coast Guard. Every vessel needs to be either documented by the Coast Guard or registered with the state of its residence. That boat's been documented since day one. Typically, in a lien sale kind of situation, an impoundment situation with a documented vessel, if it is currently documented, in other words, if the document is valid and current, it's a federal maritime lien, which in and of itself costs about $10,000 just to get to the point of getting in front of a federal judge to do the lien sale. If a boat falls out of documentation, it no longer, our understanding is no longer subject to that federal seizure and lien process. It falls to the state's process, so we have to go through the state lien sale like we do with some of our other smaller boats.
Which is far simpler than the federal process.
Far simpler. But it's based on money owed. It's based on an outstanding bill. And with no outstanding bill, no lien sale.
Any other questions or comments? Jim?
One that just came up as a consequence of Lynn's question, who is paying the bill for what you've done so far to remove the fuel and all?
We've been paying it so far. We intend to bill Mr. Sullivan for that because we've gave him every opportunity to try and take care of it and gave him the names of, you know, people that can help him take care of it, and so far it just hasn't happened, so we intend to bill him for it and just go from there. It's an unfortunate situation all around. I don't like it, but I'm not going to stand by and watch that boat sink and be a major pollution issue either.
Is there anything beyond the harbor department that the city council or the city attorney can do to move things along to prevent the sinking?
I think the only thing that's going to prevent sinking is the boat's out of the water, really. And there's, you know, it's private property, and there's you know, hoops that you have to jump through and laws that have to be abided by to deal with that.
Dan?
So it sounds like it may be the best advice, but probably can't give this advice to his niece, is to not pay the bill so that it will go to lien. I mean, otherwise you can't do anything. I mean, to speed this up, that would be the quicker course to take. Okay, but I guess we can't really.
Or they could just give us a check for $20,000.
All right, we'll come back to order.
It would be nice if the owner would participate in helping taking care of that boat. I mean, we'll help, we'll assist, we'll bend over backwards, sideways, left and right, and try and do what we can, but it would be nice if the owner could participate.
And I would like to make a statement, too, with regard to that. The communications that I've seen come from the Harbor Department, the Harbor Office, have been nothing but professional and cordial and helpful, and from everything I've seen, they've tried to assist in every way possible. If anyone has different information than that, as a board, we'd sure like to hear about that, but that's what I've seen. Any other questions or comments with regard to the Harbor Director's status report? All right, we got a lot of mileage out of that one, Eric. Anything else with regard to your report? No, good. Well, we are grateful and excited that we have two groups here with us tonight to give us presentations. The first one is item B2 on our agenda, and that is a presentation from our National Estuary Program. And Adrian, the director of that program, is here to speak about the eelgrass situation in the bay. So, Adrian, please come on up and introduce yourself again and welcome.
Thank you. Good evening. I apologize. I have PowerPoint slides because there's a few maps that I wanted to show you. If for some reason you can't see them on the screen, I can provide the PowerPoint to city staff afterwards. Eelgrass, it's a collaborative effort among a number of entities in the community. And I put here in red that eelgrass is in critical condition because we do feel that the eelgrass habitat in our bay is in critical condition. I have a picture here of healthy eelgrass from around the 2007 timeframe, and then again a picture taken in 2012 of basically open mudflats where there used to be eelgrass beds in Morro Bay. We had historically very healthy eelgrass in Morro Bay, but we've seen a dramatic decline over the last few years, and I'm going to talk about that here. So eelgrass fluctuates naturally. This is a graph of monitoring data from various methods of collection from the 60s to now. And as you can see from this graph, it goes up, it goes down. It's a natural process of oscillating how many acres we have in the bay. Eelgrass is sensitive to a number of things, changes in temperature, light, and nutrient levels, as well as sometimes desiccation can be a concern for beds when at low tide. So in the past, we have seen low levels in the bay. In 1997, we saw only around 100 acres in the bay. But now, this year, we're actually recording only about 17, which is considerably less than that. As a side note, black brant geese, you can see that their population fluctuates along with the eelgrass because it's one of their number one food sources while they're here. So eelgrass grows throughout the West Coast. It also grows on the East Coast. These are dots of where the major eelgrass beds are in California. Morro Bay historically has been the sixth largest eelgrass bed in California. It was a very important area for eelgrass, especially in the Central Coast, as you can see from this map. There really isn't any other extensive eelgrass beds between the San Francisco Bay Area and the LA area. And it's an important food source for, in particular, black brant migratory birds coming through the bay. So now I have a number of maps to show you. The Morro Bay National Estuary Program has been tracking how much acreage of eelgrass is in the bay over time. And these are maps we've created from aerial imagery. We actually hire someone to fly a plane across the bay and take pictures. And then we go out and ground truth that, and we can tell what signature is actually eelgrass versus mud versus other things. So in 2007, we had 344 acres in the bay. And you can see that this has declined over the years. And in 2010, we had about 179 acres. And you can see where it, the laser pointer isn't that large. You can see that it's declined in particular in the southern and central parts of the bay over that time frame. The green, of course, is eelgrass in the bay. We just flew a flight earlier this spring in 2013, and this is the map we just got back from the contractors that we work with. Approximately 17 acres, that includes the intertidal and the subtidal. The map I have here is just the intertidal, so that's about 10 acres of eelgrass. And I apologize, I wanted to give you the whole bay view, but it makes it very difficult to actually see where the eelgrass is growing because it is so few. But you can see it here in the northern part of the bay. This is where the healthiest eelgrass beds have been historically over the last few years. You can see it here growing around Coleman Beach, here across from the docks, down along here. There's some down here by the State Park Marina. But again, this central and southern part of the bay, where we've normally had very extensive eelgrass beds, has declined. In some areas, there's just absolutely no eelgrass at all. So why is this? Everyone wants to know. The specific cause of the decline is not clear. You know, unfortunately, when you're talking about ecological systems, it's very complex, and it's not super easy to find the smoking gun, and there typically isn't one specific cause. There are probably several factors working against eelgrass in our bay. As I mentioned, it's sensitive to temperature change and loss of light, and that's a big key, I think, we think in this, is that it has to get enough sunlight. Fluctuations in sediment levels in the bay or nutrients can help shift, unfortunately, the paradigm between algae and eelgrass. One other thing that we saw from 2009 to 2010 that we observed and documented was a 334% increase in Gracilaria, that's a red algae species. Those of you who spend a lot of time in the bay have probably seen that we have great green algae blooms in the spring, and sometimes in the fall we have quite large red algae blooms. We think that the algae has actually in some places been smothering the eelgrass. Monitoring eelgrass for many years in the bay, and in 2012 when we saw this dramatic decline, we felt that we could no longer just be monitoring the situation, that we needed to take a proactive or an active role in trying to recover eelgrass. So we designed with some outside experts a 5-step eelgrass recovery program, where basically the nutshell of this very complicated list of things is that we plant some eelgrass and we monitor it and we see if it grows and if it doesn't grow, and then we learn from that, and then we go back the following year and plant some more in the areas where we actually saw eelgrass grow. And it's a cyclical cycle that we hope to do over a 5-year period, hopefully planting a little bit more eelgrass every year, seeing it start to bounce back on its own. There are a number of partners that have been involved in this program. The top list of logos is the major donors for the program. So you see the Black Brant Group, Audubon, Fish and Wildlife Service, ourselves, the Hein Foundation, and Keith Merkel and Associates, the outside expert that we've been working with. A diverse group of entities working together because we want to see eelgrass come back to the bay. The logos on the bottom are a suite of organizations that actually helped provide volunteers or in-kind help this year when we did the planting. And again, you know, from the city to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to local divers to Pizza Port, all members of the community have been helping out on this effort. So why do we care? And that's because healthy eelgrass beds mean a healthy bay. You know, some of you who are boat owners might be thinking secretly, it's pretty great. No eelgrass means no eelgrass stuck in my propellers. However, the eelgrass in our bay is fundamentally important to the creatures that live here. Many of the animals and other organisms that are living in the bay live in and around the eelgrass. They eat the eelgrass. So it's pretty important to keep that cycle of the health of the bay to have eelgrass here. And, you know, even some of the commercial fish species that we'd like to eat need eelgrass, like flounder, rockfish, steelhead, and sand dabs. So in 2012, we did our first planting. It was a pilot effort. We only did about 21 plots, working with Audubon and Black Brant Group. And we saw growth in about half of those plots, which was great. You're not going to get 100% growth when you're doing a restoration project. And the experts that we were working with were really excited to see that it was very consistent what depth profile the eelgrass was growing in. So we took that information when we designed this year's planting to try and hopefully make it even more successful from the 2013 planting, which we did in August. Our goal was to plant 40 plots, so doubling the effort, which is about 8,000 planting bundles. There's a couple eelgrass shoots in a bundle. We worked with over 100 volunteers from the community. These are pictures from the actual week-long event. We worked with divers helping get healthy eelgrass from the Coleman Beach area, bringing it on shore, or volunteers bundled it. We gave it back to divers, and they were planting it in parts of the central and southern part of the bay where we've seen the most dramatic declines and where we would like to see eelgrass come back. That's roughly about 2.2 acres. So you're thinking, gosh, you've lost 300 acres and you've only planted 2.2 acres? Well, again, we're really hoping that what we're doing is seeding in various places in the bay, and that Mother Nature will kind of take over and start growing from those nodes that we're creating. Oh, and we exceeded our goal this last year and actually planted 9,775 units. It was, if any of you came by Coleman Beach the week that we were doing the planting, I think people were excited to see community members out there. I think most of the people involved had a really good time. So that was my presentation for you. I'd be happy to answer any questions. If you're interested in being involved in this project or others, please contact us. This is our website, www.mbnep.org. That's the acronym for Morro Bay National Estuary Program. And please donate. We're looking for donations to help with the eelgrass effort in particular, and we are rolling out our first annual campaign next week. So you may see information from us on that, and you can go to our website and click the donate button and donate to the effort. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian, for a great presentation. We'll now open to question or comments from board members. We'll start down at the end. Jim?
I have no questions at this time.
All right, thank you, Jim. Dana?
The name of that disease again, what was that called? Wasting?
Wasting disease. It's a slime mold.
Okay.
But I will just make the note that we think it's wasting disease. We're not 100% sure because it's not acting as like typical wasting disease would act.
Nothing down at this end?
Commercial fishing organization. So Eric asked us to get some fishermen together to talk about different gear types tonight. And so I got an array of people that do different fisheries. I guess we'll start from shallow to deep. I'm a nearshore fisherman and a spot prawn fisherman, so I'll start at the nearshore. The nearshore fishery probably started in the early 90s here. It's a live fish fishery where we catch fish and 60 feet and in mostly. There's about five main fish that we catch: cabazon, greenling, gopher cod, grass bass, and link cod. It's not on the near shore list, but that's about the array of fish that we catch on a Morro Bay. We catch some balena and some like coppers and fish like that, but the five main fish are the ones I mentioned first. There's about 20 participants in Morro Bay that are doing the near shore fishery. It's a fishery that we do with hooks or traps. We use both. There's the guys that use the traps are regulated by Fish and Game, that they have a trap endorsement along with their nearshore permit. And then the guys that just fish hooks don't have a trap endorsement just are allowed to fish hooks. But mostly everyone in Morro Bay pretty much has a trap endorsement now, so everybody's fishing traps. There's a couple guys that are just still fishing hooks. In 2007, the MPAs, 29 MPAs went in the Central Coast. We were the first one to get them. So that really cut down on our area that we fished. So a lot of guys diversified and went to other fisheries and started doing other things. A lot of guys quit, sold their permits. But so it's a But right now, it's pretty much, there's about at least 20 guys that are still fishing steady and delivering to the markets. The fish go to L.A. and San Francisco. They get picked up from trucks that come up here. We have quotas now, which we never had before, and they go in two-month waves. We have five waves during the year, and we're allowed so much fish every wave. Every fish has its own category and how much we can catch. Over the years, since the quotas have started, they started about 5 years ago. It has increased almost every year for all the fish. Like right now, it's up to 500 pounds of cabazon a wave, 200 pounds of greenling, which was only 25 for a long time a month, or for 2 month period, but now it's up to 200. The finfish category, which are the gopher cod and the grass bass, is about up to 800 to 900 pounds a wave. So they've seen in the research that we've done in the nearshore that the stocks are healthy, and so they've increased our catch over the years. So that helps out a lot. The prices are pretty much the same as they've been through the whole years that we've been fishing. It's about $10 to about $5 a pound for the fish, and which the grass bass is we get paid more for, because it's they liked the grass bass more than gopher cod or baleen. It's about $9 to $10 a pound. We're really regulated. There's a lot of different rules that we have to go by. We're allowed to transfer our permits, seller permits, but to sell the permit, if a guy wanted to buy a nearshore permit, he'd have to find two to get one. It's a two-for-one kind of deal that will decrease the people in the fishery, and it's worked over the years. It's the capacity goal is way down now. They're starting to look at a one-to-one transfer. We've been trying to push Fishing Game to do that. So they're starting to look at it a little bit more than they were, because the capacity goal is way down now. So the two-for-one isn't really necessary anymore. It could go to one-to-one. So we've been working on that. Okay, that's about it on the nearshore. So I'll spot, and that's what made it hard for the nearshore guys, because we lost a lot of area. All of our best areas they took. So we're kind of in little spots now where we can go, and which I don't think is very good, because I think it causes overfishing, but I'm sure we'll see in the future what happens. So any more questions on the nearshore? You good on that? Okay, so spot prawns. Spot prawns is now a trap fishery only. About 10 years ago, they stopped the trawling of spot prawns. And it went to all traps. There is about 17 permits in the state that are allowed to catch spot prawns under a Tier 1 access. That means that we can have up to 500 traps. We don't have a quota. We basically can fish wherever we want, if we're not in an MPA. They did make some room for the spot prawn guys in the conservation area, so we didn't lose all of our areas around Big Sur and Point Lobos and Monterey Canyon and those areas, because there's a few guys that fish spot prawns up there. But basically, there's four guys north of Point Conception that fish spot prawns, and all the other permits are south of Point Conception. So it's a pretty well-regulated fishery. There's not a lot of guys doing it. When the trawlers were trawling for them, we had a lot of trawlers here in Morro Bay that were catching spot prawns. They probably caught 1.5 or more pounds of spot prawns every year. Now we're down to about 250,000 pounds a year, so the resource is pretty much protected now. A lot of guys that fish spot prawns don't fish 500 traps, especially up north of Point Conception. The guys below fish them a little different than we do. They fish in flatter areas. We pretty much all fish in the canyons up here. The majority of us only use about 150 to 200 traps. It's a live fishery, too. We keep the spot prawns alive. The markets, L.A. and San Francisco, come and get them. The fishery has been around since the 40s. It started in Monterey with old Italians fished up there in the Monterey Canyon for octopus. And they were catching a lot of spot prawns in their octopus traps. These traps are basket traps made out of wicker and bamboo in the day. And as it progressed, they got a little bit, you know, they saw that they were catching the spot prawns. And so a few of the Italians up there kept fishing, and they made a little market for it. And it just has increased over the years. And now it's a healthy, vibrant fishery, and it's one of the good fisheries out of Morro Bay. Okay. Any questions on that?
I just have a question. Are these the same vessel? Is this the same vessel you use for both of these, or two different vessels, or for yourself?
Yeah, for myself, I can use the big boat for near shore and for spot prawns. A lot of the nearshore guys have smaller boats, so they can get in closer to the beach. But, yeah, I can use my boat for both fisheries. If I don't like to get shallow, I stay out deep.
How big is your boat?
I have a Catherine H. It's 43 foot.
43. Where do you haul out?
I haul out in Moss Landing, and I would like to haul out here. In fact, I have a proposal written up that shows us how much it would cost, and I can show it to you guys if you want. I don't have any with me, but we are working on that. If we can, you know, it'd be a good project for Morro Bay to get, and there is grant money out there to get if we could get some of that grant money. But we're working on it.
Hopefully you'll be on our board.
Okay, good. On the questions? Any more?
Tom, how deep are you fishing prawns, trapping?
We fish about 1,000 feet for prawns in the canyons, up starting at San Simeon all the way up to Big Sur. So they're pretty deep. They're even deeper than that, but I don't like going more than 1,000. Okay. So there's some other fishermen that are coming up to speak about the different fisheries and gear types in Morro Bay.
Actually, is acquiring quota from the Nature Conservancy to anchor it here in town so that the local fishermen will be able to continue to use it, because there's a big fear that if something like that didn't happen, then the quota would migrate north into and end up in Newport and Astoria, Oregon. I'm proud to be participating in that program. As part of that program, we're required to carry a federal observer for 100% of our fishing trips. They weigh everything that comes on board, and as a measure to stop overfishing, you know, harvest of non-target species and discard. It was, kind of giving my fishery a black eye for a long time, and so these are steps that we took to try to make it sustainable. So part of the fish, part of the catch I deliver is live. It's a deeper water fish than what Tom was talking about. They're out in 400 fathoms, that's 2,400 feet or so, and in addition to that, we like Petrelli sole, Dover sole, chili pepper rockfish. So, and also part of the when we switch to the IFQ system, we no longer have to use a trawl net to harvest our fish. You can use any type of gear that's you know, recognized by the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. So there are guys that are catching trawl quota, but they're using hooks or a pot, traps, stuff like that. It's very complicated, though. So I'll go ahead and be done here unless you have any questions. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead, Ron.
I'd just like to say that I agree with that first gentleman. It would be nice to have a haul-out facility here. The closest place that can haul my boat is Ventura, so 100 miles of fuel burning before I even start paying, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather spend that money here in town.
I think the entire board's in agreement with you, with both of you. We're heading in that direction.
Great.
Rob, I'd like to solicit just a comment or two more from you with regard to observers. When I first found out about what observers are and how they work and who has to pay for them, I was surprised about all that. So maybe just a couple more comments with regard to observers on board your vessel.
Sure. Well, in the beginning, an observer, right? They're actually not a federal employee, but they subcontract to the federal government. It's the one I use is from Alaskan Observers Incorporated. The first year of the program, NOAA paid for 90% of the bill, and I paid for 10%. Right now, we're at 60-40. The daily what it costs per day is $425, so I'm paying, you know, close to $200 a day to have this guy on board. We fought it a lot, it seemed like an inconvenience, but actually I participate in a very controversial fishery, and with that observer there, I can now prove that I'm not as dirty of a fisherman as everybody thought I was at one time. I mean, I have the numbers, and it's not another guy that, you know, it's a federal observer, college-educated guy, keeping track of all this stuff. So that's a nice part of it, but it does hurt paying for it.
Thank you. Any other questions for Rob?
Yeah. How many tons is the South Bay?
I mean, it's about 60 gross tons.
Thanks.
Yeah. The Moss Landing place can't haul me.
Lynn, did you have some?
Yeah, how many pounds of fish do you bring in one trip?
In one trip, around 15,000 to 30,000 pounds. In 2012, I landed about 900,000 pounds of fish. You know, that went to local markets, restaurants. Seems like a lot, but like the Dover sole, you know, it's an average of 45 cents per pound. And so it takes a lot more. We employ more fillets and use more eyes and fuel. Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Rob. Appreciate it.
Good evening, Chairman and members of the board, and I'd like to say hi to all the supporters we have. On the boats, we have about 90 active vessels that are making landings, and they employ between 130 and 150 fishermen. There's another 50 individuals who have employment, either delivering fuel and ice, unloading the boats, and working, filleting the product in the markets. This is a vital industry to Morro Bay, and we've always had good support here, and we want to tell you we appreciate it. I'd kind of like to move on to my fishery, drift gillnet fishery. Another fishery that is observed and does have some issues in the past, and I'll address those. We, in 1994, they had the reauthorization of the Marine Mammal Act, and that pretty much says you can't catch marine mammals. They put in some very strict restrictions, and a timetable to have this accomplished. Well, fishermen raised to the challenge, and a guy in the back east created a pinger. And I don't know if you can hear this pinger. Some people can hear it and some can't. This is advanced to the point where on our gear we have 60 of these pingers in three different frequencies. This particular technology has now spread throughout the world, and it's a worldwide product. Or, you know, a lot of other countries in the world now demand that we use it. And what it did, by 2009, our fishery was a Category 3 fishery, which falls into the same mammal interaction group as hook and line fishing. A lot of people thought that would never happen. A lot of people thought our fishery was dead. And in our fishery, we fish off to 100 miles off the coast, and we land several types of fish. Swordfish, bluefin tuna, albacore, opa, thresher shark, mako shark, pomfret, and Morro Bay is the third largest swordfish landing port on the West Coast. It's important here, this fishery. In 2011, the fishery put, the group of fishermen put $1 million worth of product across our docks. Hence, we draw, because of the Central Coast, fishermen from other ports who will work here, pay transient fees, buy fuel, help keep our infrastructure running. It is an important fishery. Boy, I already did that page. This is going good. Okay. So I'd just like to say again that it is an important fishery, and we do appreciate the community's support. In the fall, well, the fishery starts legally August 15th and runs through January 31st. In the Central Coast here, the prime months are September, October, November, usually around the Thanksgiving storms, about when we find it very difficult to work here, and a lot of us will move down to the southern area. And at that point, I think I've covered all my points. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Tom. Any questions for Tom? On this end? Lynn?
What did you call that little thing?
Oh, this is a, we call them pingers.
A painter.
Pinger.
Pinger.
P-I-N-G-E-R.
Okay.
This particular one puts out a 10 kilohertz signal every 4 seconds. And in the water, it travels a fair amount of distance. We have another pinger that's a 3 kilohertz, which is a deeper sound. For some of the larger mammals are at a lower range. And we now have incorporated a 70 kilohertz pinger, for which seems to work better for common dolphins and that sort of thing. We're constantly trying to improve. In fact, the F3, what we call it an F3 because of its frequency, and an F70, have just come about in the last couple of years, and our fleet's the first one to use this combination to create an acoustic wall of sound. And with the results that we had, it's just really impressive. Almost all the mammals have an echolocation system, and this seems to tell them, hey, pay attention.
Any other questions for Tom?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate it.
Oh, one other comment. The Morro Bay Fishermen's Organization has a 2012 commercial fisheries report. And if you type into Google Central Coast Cable Fisheries, you'll get the Cable Fisheries Liaison Committee's website. And the 2012 and the 2013, well, we call it the 2013 report. 2013 is actually 2012, and 2012 is actually 2011. You can read a lot of interesting facts and figures about fishing here in Morro Bay, and the website has an extensive photo.
When I first came to Morro Bay, at any time there could be a fleet of 20, 30, 40 albacore boats in the area tied up here, making bait in Avila, rafted to the pier in Avila. Now there's between 8 and 10 boats in Morro Bay that actively pursue albacore on given seasons. There's about 6 of us that pursue them every year. My boat carries about 26,000 pounds of fish. I blast freeze them. I freeze them to 40 below zero. I go into the sashimi market with my fish. The rest of the boats in this town are brine boats. They're primarily cannery boats. Right now, if I came into this port with a full load of fish, I couldn't sell it. If I came in with a half a load of fish, I couldn't sell it. If I came in with a quarter of a load of fish, I couldn't sell it. I might be able to sell 1,000 or 2,000 pounds to a local buyer. That would be about it. There's no facility here for volume. If all the boats that fish out of this port all came in with full loads of fish, we couldn't sell it here. We might possibly be able to attract an out-of-town buyer from Oregon or from Washington to send a reefer truck down and do it, but most of them don't want to bother with that small amount of fish. And most of the boats carry about the same as what I do, most of the boats that fish out of here. The cycles of albacore have been such that we've had real poor seasons in California for the last 10 or 15 years, and so we all end up traveling to Oregon and Washington. But every year for the last 3 or 4 years, we've been seeing more and more fish in California. I finished this last trip off Eureka, and we had really good fishing there. There were scores there. I only needed about 200 fish to finish my trip, and I did that in a day. There were boats that had 400, 600, 800 fish in a day off Eureka this year. There were fish down off Shelter Cove, off Fort Bragg, not large volumes. Fish off San Francisco, not large volumes, but commercial quantities. So the fish seem to be coming back to California. But as of right now, anybody in California that caught a load of fish like mine would have to go back to Coos Bay, Oregon to sell it. We've talked a lot. I worked with Rick Elgert a lot on freezer facilities, things like that. If we had the ability to collect fish into large lumps where it would make sense for a reefer truck to come down or several reefer trucks to come down and haul them away, that would make that a viable business here. It would put that money back into our county. Or if the fishery comes back in a big way here, then the buyers will follow, but it's usually a 2 or 3 year lag time. So again, we'll be running back up to San Francisco at the very least. Chances are somewhere on the other side of the Oregon border to sell the fish. I do largely public sales. I'll usually fish 2 trips up in the Pacific Northwest and sell to buying stations. My fish goes anywhere from loining machines that put on white tablecloth restaurants throughout this country and Canada to all over Europe, and a lot of my fish now go to Japan. I fish for the Alaska Seafood Producers Cooperative, and that fish is processed and sent to Japan as sashimi. All the fish that are being caught now, used to be a person would see an albacore come off a boat and you weren't really sure what kind of fish it was, because it was kind of smashed and misshapen and caught in high volume with not a lot of attention to detail. Now even the brine boats are freezing a fish down to like 2 and 3 degrees. They're making them hard and round so that they can be loined. They can be used for multiple purposes. Albacore doesn't just go in a can now. It goes on your table. It goes into the sashimi markets, the sushi bars. It goes all over the place. So we'd really like to see, one, the fishery return here so we can stay home and fish and not have to go get our butts beat up in Oregon all the time. And two, if funding comes for things like haul-up facilities and such, we'd like to see maybe at least a look taken at a freezer facility. It would accommodate black cod, it would accommodate albacore, it would accommodate all sorts of fish that we catch here. It would make this town a lot more viable as a hub for fishing. We're kind of out of the way for big trucks. Nobody wants to come for just a single load of fish or a couple loads of fish. So it's something that could really help this harbor. Since our fishing potential and our fishing catches seem to be increasing yearly now, we seem to be on the other side of the equation. It'd be nice to make this a true, strong fishing port the way it always has been, and it's on its way now. Albacore stocks seem to be getting better and better every year. It's one of the few fish that anybody can still go pursue. You don't have to have a permit. You don't have to have an observer. You don't have to have a VMS on the boat. You can go buy $500 worth of equipment and go make a living catching tuna. It's one of the things that a young guy can still get into. And salmon is my second most important fishery. And again, this year, my wife and I were allowed to fish here for the first month and a half. We had really good fishing. There was good fishing up and down the whole coast. And the public has become so aware of the value of wild fish over farm fish that we retained a really good price, probably the best continuous price I've seen since I've fished salmon. We often had 100 fish days, so did everybody around us. Some of the really good guys had 150, 200 fish days on a constant basis, and our price never fell. It always stayed strong. So salmon is a real bright spot on the coast, and from what we saw on the oceanic conditions, feed sources, both for albacore and salmon. The ocean is the healthiest I've seen it in years. They're starting from Pigeon Point South is winter run habitat. And at the informational meeting prior to our salmon season opening, our Cal Fish and Game, or they have a new name now, but their person putting out the information was addressed by several fishermen saying, well, if we didn't fish at all, if you just took us off the ocean, would the winter run stock be in any better shape? And they said, absolutely not. Most of those fish are being ground up in the pumps that pump the water into the agricultural industry in the valley. So we don't really have an impact, but we're the ones that pay the price for it. One other kind of interesting thing, and I've talked to this board about it in the past, is we go into Half Moon Bay every year, have for 25 years, selling albacore to the public. We have between 500 and 600 people on a mailing list. We let them know when we're coming. But while we're there, we see 18-foot boats selling live halibut to the public. We see 16-foot boats selling whatever they can catch, whether it's sardines or squid or smelt or whatever, to the public. We're there for generally 5 days, and we can sell almost a whole load of fish there in 5 days. And for every person we sell fish to, we probably talk to 20, 30, 40 other people that just ask questions. They're just interested. There's every ethnicity there. They all eat fish now. They all want to know who the person is that caught their fish. It's a pretty phenomenal thing. Guys who couldn't make a living otherwise can keep the bills paid and make a living by dealing directly with the public. And when we started selling there, for a lot of years we were the only boat. And then the harbor kind of saw the value of it, and they put in a dock just for public sales. We have to buy a permit to sell there. We have to pay an increased fee to use that public sales dock. But people come every day of the week, and on the weekends it's just nonstop, to see what's being sold at the sales dock. The harbor office in Half Moon Bay has an answering machine, has a tape loop. Everybody that comes in to sell fish checks in with the harbor office. They say when they're going to be there, what they've got for sale. So people can just call a number, get a recording, and find out what's available, what's for sale. The retailers there, the fish markets and the large buying plants and things were really kind of opposed to it when it began. And then they discovered that, well, when a person comes to buy a tuna from Craig, he also decides he wants a shrimp cocktail, and maybe he wants some halibut, maybe he wants some salmon, and maybe he wants whatever they have to offer, and their sales went up when we came. We bring people from all over the valley, you know, from San Jose, from Stockton, from everywhere. They come to Half Moon Bay to buy our albacore, but they also eat in the restaurants. They also buy the gasoline. They also go to the grocery stores. They also buy the other seafood products from the other retailers there. It's a win-win for everybody when that happens. So that's one other thing I'd like you to look at. And I worked with Rick on this for quite a while, but with EIRs for eelgrass and things like that, we could never put the pieces together for some sort of public sales dock. And if you're going to be looking at a haul-out facility, and you have that lease site available, it might be something to consider. It could help increase the number of people who can make a living in this port commercial fishing. It would also tremendously increase the foot traffic of people coming here to actually purchase stuff instead of just to come and enjoy the sun, maybe buy some ornaments or some decorations. The valley that everybody comes here from has every ethnicity we deal with up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and they all love fish. And it could be a real boost for the local economy. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you, Craig. I want to get some clarification for you on one thing. You mentioned the ability of this port to offload larger quantities of fish, and it used to be more, and now it's less.
It's not the ability of the port. It's the buyers that have the access to market it. That's the issue. It's not the
And that's ability. What I wanted to get to. So is it infrastructure, or it's the number of buyers? Or maybe even
it's,
both.
It's the direction the buyers have been forced to go because there hasn't been a local product. I mean, I don't blame the buyers. If I came in and said I've got, you know, 25,000 pounds of minus 40 degree albacore, Gio, would you buy it? He doesn't know what to do with it. He's got nowhere to go with it. He can't put it on a container and ship to Japan. It's not enough. He can't offload it to the local restaurants because he doesn't have the facility to hold that fish to do it a little bit at a time. Infrastructure is a part of it, but mainly we just haven't had the fish here to have the larger buyers that have the capacity to move that kind of volume on a regular basis.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for Craig? Down at this end, Lynn?
Yes, Craig, I remember seeing some photographs of probably 4 or 5 big trawlers all side-tied down at the marina.
Yep.
Bayfront, now called Bayfront, but down at the fuel dock. Where did they used to sell their fish?
Again, when that was going on, we had buying stations here that bought albacore. I mean, we had U.S. canneries. So that fish was taken from here to San Pedro and canned. Well, we don't have U.S. canneries to speak of anymore. That stuff has all gone offshore. With the cost of labor and everything that we have in this country now, most of that's gone offshore. What has changed in the Pacific Northwest is people have started buying loining machines. They've been buying product like mine, and they... So, you know, and again, as I said, it appears that the albacore, the southern run of albacore, seems to be coming back. It's getting better and better further and further south every year. So I'd like us to kind of be prepared for that, you know. I'd like, before my career is over, to be able to come deliver full loads of albacore into the town I live in. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Appreciate that. Hey, Craig, we do have another question for you before you run off. Dana.
Hi, Dana.
Hi, Craig. So you're selling albacore off your boat right now.
I am now sold out. I have been for the last 4 or 5 days.
Oh, okay. So can you describe the sales dock a little better to us, kind of give us a picture?
Well, a sales dock in Half Moon Bay, there's a felt pen board right at the front door of the harbor office. And when you come in, every morning you get up, you race every night, every morning you come, go up and you sign on it and you put what you have there. And then, like, we call Half Moon Bay and say we're coming in with albacore, and we give them the dates we'll be there. We sell there typically for 5 days. So they put on their loop that, you know, the preamble is coming in with blast blade albacore. And then if they see that I haven't signed in the morning, then they may take that off the loop, or they may check with me and see if I'm continuing to sell. Half Moon Bay is more of a center. They've got one pier, and most of the commercial boats come off that one pier, so it's a more centrally located area. Where Morro Bay, it's a little more difficult. Like if somebody down where Tom was trying to sell fish, it would be a little more difficult because there's not a lot of parking. He's better than the guys, oh, by the Whale's Tail, that area. That's a real difficult area to try and sell fish out of your slip because there's no parking. People can't go buy. I have customers buy 200, 300, 500 pounds, 1,000 pounds of fish at a time. They can pull their truck out on the pier, and I put it up in buggies and wheel it up to their truck. Well, if you're parked down, you know, in the main tourist area of this town, you can't do that. It can't possibly work. So you kind of need a central hub, something like Tidelands Park, but that parking is really limited as well. So if you had a sales dock that was where the primary area of parking is in Morro Bay, which is, you know, PG&E area, that would be an ideal place for a sales dock, and it would be, again, as I said, it would be a large draw for the city. Sometimes it's phenomenal. We go into Half Moon Bay, and the first day we're in there, we have a line of people, kind of like Mark does here, from 7 in the morning till 7 at night. We have a line of people buying fish, and most of them are from 100 to 300-pound orders. A lot of them are larger than that, but, you know, a few people come by one fish, two fish, a 10-pound fish, an 8-pound fish, but the majority of our customers want 20, 30, 40, 20-pound fish. That's what they're Portuguese people who came from the Azores that love to can fish. But now we've got Russian clients, we've got Japanese clients, we've got Chinese clients, we've got Indian people that didn't typically eat tuna now eat tuna because there's been so little fresh local fish available.
My other question is about the freezer facility. It sounds like the fisheries are all coming back, so maybe we should start thinking about preparing more and more for this market. And would this draw boats from Monterey or outside our area, if we had a freezer?
You know, there are lots of commercial albacore boats from Crescent City South. And if the albacore come back the way they appear to be coming back, and they were here, absolutely. Not just albacore, though. I mean, black cod freeze as well. Black cod gets shipped to Japan a lot in a frozen state. Salmon freeze as well. You know, Wayne Moody and myself have the ability to freeze salmon. A lot of our salmon trolling partner boats are strictly freezer boats. They only freeze their salmon. When we're getting $4 a pound, they put their fish away, put it in a cold storage facility, and at the end of the season they get $8.50 a pound for that same fish. So it's in their best interest to just keep their whole season on the boat, put it in freezer facilities, which they do in Olympia, Bellingham, Westport, Washington, and a large portion of that fish is sold down into San Francisco to buyers that we deal with. Some of it is sold into Half Moon Bay to a large salmon buyer there. Again, people want local fish and they want wild fish. They don't. They kind of see the downside environmentally and health-wise of eating farm fish. It's not really a healthy product to eat, at least in the salmon. You know, the land-based farm-raised seafood creatures are quite a bit cleaner and healthier, but they don't have the environmental issues cleared up on the ocean-raised farm fish. So people really prefer to buy from somebody they've met, or at least somebody that they know works off their coast.
Thank you, Craig. Please introduce yourself and your boat.
My name is Bill Blue, a fisherman in Morro Bay since 1974. I have the fishing vessel Breda Michelle and the fishing vessel Morning Light. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the fixed gear sablefish fishery, which I participate in. That particular fishery actually so did the fishery. In 2006, with the closures of salmon season and higher prices for black cod, the open access fishery in this area, there's three segments of ways to harvest sablefish. There's the open access segment, there's the limited entry fixed gear, which is a permit fishery that some have just the permit, some have a certain amount of quota attached to them. And then there's the trawl segment, which, as Rob spoke to earlier, now is referred to as an IFQ fishery. So in 2006, this area had a very high stock assessment, and the limits for open access were extremely high. They were probably higher than anywhere else on the coast. So with the closure of salmon season, a lot of people went into the open access black cod fishery, and it kind of just took off like wildfire. Through 08, 09, until salmon season opened again. So for a few years, this port saw an extreme influx of out-of-town boats because of the high quota. The fishery kind of ran away with itself, and it became a directed fishery, the open access segment of it, which wasn't what it was intended for. So there was a lot of council interaction, changing of quotas. They ratcheted it down. And then salmon season happened again, so people went back to fishing salmon, and that kind of left the sablefish fishery back to the limited entry guys and people that were participating in the IFQ fishery. So the fishery peaked in 2011. There was several million pounds of black cod landed. The price was, ex-vessel price was an average of about $3.45 a pound. In 2012... the price of the fish, average vessel price, as the market plummeted and the resource kind of had taken a pretty hard hit from all the effort, went to about $2.60 a pound. This year we're averaging roughly about $2.20 a pound. There's six limited entry permits in this town that are local. There's six limited entry limited entry boats here right now from out of town, four from Monterey, one from Alaska, and there's two boats that are here right now participating in the IFQ gear switching. They're fishing trawl quota with traps from Astoria, Oregon. Locally, there's two people that participate in the IFQ fishery, myself and David Rose. We lease fish from the Nature Conservancy at this time, and we'll be leasing fish from the city hopefully next year. So I fish with traps. David fishes with hooks. The fishery it's a good fishery for us. The way that we do it, it works for us, and it works for the guys that are doing it. I agree with Craig. There's a lot more of the marketing could be done if we had freezer facility. We're kind of forced to sell to who we can, and because of our location, we don't receive anywhere near the price that other ports do because it has to travel from who we sell it to be processed to somebody else to be frozen to finally be shipped. So if we had a little more control of our own product, I think it would be more beneficial for all of those that participate in those fish, in that fishery here.
Thank you, Bill. We'll take some questions. Do you? No questions.
Okay. No, I have no questions.
All right. You did a great job, Bill.
Yes,
all right. Thank you.
So I also participate in the Dungeness crab fishery, which was the first fishery that I participated in when I first moved to Morro Bay in 1974. There's a half a dozen fishermen in Morro Bay. It's a limited entry fishery as well. Basically takes the bulk of the fishery normally participates from San Francisco north. There's four or five guys in Port San Luis that have Dungeness crab permits. The last couple years we were fortunate to see Dungeness crab is a very sustainable fishery. It's regulated by season, by sex, and by size. So there's no way you can fish the resource out of existence. It's a cyclic fishery. The spawning is, how do I want to say, it's fresh water and lends to a good spawn. And this area usually has a good cycle every 8 years, where in the north it's every 4 years. And luckily the last 2 years we didn't have to go anywhere. We were able to fish right here at home. Right now the boat's, it's around 1,800 pounds, 1,700 or 1,800 pounds a week that they're allowed to deliver. And they're allowed to deliver that in this area 8 weeks out of the year, I believe. Some of the permits have an endorsement to them. There's a Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 endorsement. That allows them to harvest 10,000 pounds, 18,000 pounds, and up to 30-something thousand pounds for a Tier 1 permit. That part of the fishery starts in the springtime, and it all has to take place. It starts in April, and all of it has to take place. The fishing and the landing of that product has to happen from 36 North, which is Point Lopez. So none of the tier portion of the limited entry A permits is landed here in Morro Bay. A couple of the guys here have that small endorsement. They're Tier 3. The difference between the limited entry and what I do in leasing the fish is that we lease a certain amount of quota, and we're allowed to harvest that at will. So our trips are, you know, we look for better weather. My boat can carry as much as 15 or 18,000 pounds of slush black cod. So we gear up for that. We do other fisheries, so we come into the fishery in the fall months, August, and fish until the end of October, and then we switch over to crab. So for my boat, it fits for my boat and my family what we do. Mm-hmm. You know, we're also, the A permit boats are not observed. I have a physical observer just like Rob does because I'm in the trawl segment of the fishery. It costs me $162.50 a day, which I pay for. I also have cameras on my boat, VMS. We are the most regulated fishery in the world. The West Coast of the United States is the most regulated fishery in the world.
Wow. How many different kinds of permits? Which there's a separate permit for each fishery?
Almost all fisheries are, except for, as Craig said, with the exception of albacore, are okay. Permits. And the only way for a young guy to be able to start into a fishery other than albacore is to buy a permit to participate in whichever fishery he chooses.
So in total, how many permits, how many different kinds of permits are there?
Boy, I couldn't even begin to answer that.
100?
Depending on how many fish.
No, how many different species?
Species.
A lot.
25 cool. Permits, group permits maybe?
Yeah, over 20.
Over 20. Thank you.
I have a question.
Dana.
Lots of questions.
Have you guys used this online app Fishline or been contacted because of it? It's basically Half Moon Bay to Port San Luis is what it says.
Yeah, probably Craig. I think I don't know. That's relatively new.
Okay.
A lot of the marketing stuff like Craig does and Mark did in the past was. they built their own client base. Craig doesn't really need that. I don't think he can.
No, we typically sell out to the people that we normally sell to, so I'm not seeking more customers. I don't want to work any harder.
It is. I think it's a good thing for if we were to have that type of facility here where boats could sell and guys that haven't been participating selling to the public, it could work for, you know, people that are just starting to do that. It could be a good thing.
Any other questions for Bill? Thank you very much, Bill. I appreciate it.
San Francisco.
Are there any other presentations from anyone in the fishing industry? Well, that was, Dana just said that was awesome, and I agree. That was an education as well. So thank you very much for that. We have all learned a lot, and I'm sure the viewers at home have learned a lot and gained a little bit more respect for our fishing industry. So know, of course, that we serve as your partners, and we're always here to help and assist. Eric?
Yeah, I think a lot of folks out, a lot of fellows out here spoke of, you know, what they do to sell and marketing and whatnot. I think it's a perfect segue. We have another fellow here in the audience, John Greaser from the Central Coast Seafood Marketing Association, a relatively new entity around here as well, and he came and like to maybe, if I can throw him under the bus, have a word or two as well.
Thank you. Good evening. I guess I'll keep it brief. Again, my name is John Greaser. I'm the executive director of the Central California Seafood Marketing Association. I work with Bill and Rob and David and Bill's sons, as well as one member in Half Moon Bay right now. All of the members in this in-sea fishery activity and business in Morro Bay. I couldn't support more the need for infrastructure, particularly infrastructure that aligns with marketing endeavors. And I applaud all three of the different initiatives that are infrastructure-based here this evening. CCSMA fishermen harvested nearly 1.5 million pounds of groundfish last year in six main market categories: sablefish, sole, which that includes Dover, Petrolli, and English, thorny head, rockfish, flatfish, and others. Again, as I mentioned, those fish are caught using a variety of gear types, including trawl, longline, pots, traps, and our member, Steve Fitz in Half Moon Bay, uses Scottish seine. In fact, he's the only person on the North American continent using that gear type. It would be great to come back another time and get into a little bit more detail as to some of the activities that we're working on, both in the short term and the long term. My focus and the reason why these guys thought they'd want to hire me is really around marketing. It's about, again, everything that's been discussed tonight, but it's about finding a way for local fishermen to get more value for their efforts on the water and for their products. So why don't I answer any questions you might have, and again, if you'd have me, I'd love to come back at another time and get into a little bit more detail about some of our strategic goals and some of the activities that we're engaged in. I will mention one quick thing. We just started a launched a pilot project October 1st, Tuesday of this week, and alongside Fisherman Seafood Products from the CFO, we're being represented with a partner, Slow Fresh Catch, at five farmers markets in San Luis Obispo County. So that's really exciting to be partnering with them and to be getting that product out in our local venues, because I think that's one of the largest challenges right now. You can come here as a tourist, as a consumer, and it can be very challenging to eat local seafood in local restaurants, and that's a shame. But we're doing great work, and it's exciting to be here, and I'll leave it at that.
Any questions or comments for John? I just wanted to clarify one thing or ask one thing. I'm a state college kid, so sometimes a little slow on the uptake. You mentioned three initiatives that you support. that we discussed here tonight. So I want to make sure I've got those in my head. Were you referring to the freezer, to the sales dock, and what's the thing?
And the haul-out facility.
Oh, of course, the haul-out. That one goes without saying. Okay. All right. Good. I just wanted to be sure that I had those three important things down. Very good. Thank you, John. Appreciate it. And we'll get you on the agenda for a future meeting and have a detailed report.
Appreciate it.
Thank you for being here. So before we conclude item B3 on our...
I forgot my tablet, but also, if I may, I'd like to make one more. I guess it would be a plug.
Sure.
You were talking about the Harbor Festival, and this year our fishermen's organization is doing the Albacore barbecue like they always do, but this year they'll be using -30 to -40 degree flash frozen, which means frozen with cold air rather than salt brine, bled albacore that came off the preamble. So people ought to stop by and try it.
Very nice.
I'll be there.
We certainly will.
I can't resist. Thank you for reminding me. We will also be operating a booth this weekend as well and featuring chili pepper rockfish tacos that are pretty awesome. We sold them 3 weeks ago at the Avocado and Margarita Festival, and if you haven't had one, stop on by. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, John. Any other closing comments before we move on to the next topic? Yes, Jim.
I would just like to thank all of you that made presentations tonight, too. We've had on our agenda a few times in my years of being on the Harbor Advisory Board to have someone from the commercial fishing organization come up and explain what all of you did tonight. And I just wanted to thank you for your taking time out of your evening and your work to come to us and to do what you did. Thank you very much.
All right, that concludes item B3, and thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, for coming tonight. So before we moved on to unfinished business and new business, we have an item on each of those. We are going to take a 5-minute recess, 5 minutes prompt, and we will be back. Thank you. A member, Bill Luffy, left at the end of that last segment. We still maintain quorum. So we'll move on now to item C, unfinished business.
Into our rules and regulations, and then heard it and voted to forward that to the City Council. So I've brought back some draft language for you for approval, or not, hopefully approval. And if so approved, we will move it forward to the City Council. Probably there's a number of things that we need to change on our rules and regulations, some updates and some modernizations, some other things I'll address, so I'll probably be bringing a lot more than just this, because I don't often take those things because it's a resolution of council. So if you move to approve this, we will bring that forward. And this is just my first crack at a draft. I think it works for our purposes administratively. I think it also works towards what the Harbor Advisory Board wished, which was no more than 2 vessels, and that the system wasn't used as a way to kind of bypass the slip waiting list with, you know, a second boat coming in with two owners, and then that the original owner disappears and the new boat gets the slip. So I hope I've addressed it, but I'm open to input, and with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Eric. Has anything transpired between the meeting that we had back in December where we discussed this and voted on it to now?
Transpired in terms of?
Just any other significant factors that have come up?
No.
Okay.
Other than fishermen still expressing a desire, and I think you have 2 of them out here in your audience, to continue on with it, to allow that to happen.
Okay. So for the record and for the viewers at home, I'm going to read quickly the language that you are suggesting that we approve in your staff report, and it reads as follows. This language should be added to Section 2, Paragraph A of the Harbor Department Rules and Regulations. A commercial fisherman with the qualified commercial fishing vessel is defined occupying a city slip may, at the fisherman's discretion, occupy said slip with a second qualified commercial fishing vessel owned by the fisherman in place of the first vessel, provided that said second vessel is of an appropriate size for said slip and that both vessels remain qualified commercial fishing vessels as defined. This allowance will in no way be used by said fisherman for the purposes of transfer of the slip to a second owner or owners of either vessel in order to bypass the commercial slip waiting list by the second owner or owners. So with that, we will have some discussion on this, and then we'll look for a motion. To me, this looks kind of like we've already discussed this quite a bit, and it looks like pretty much an open and closed case. But we'll take any questions, comments, and then we'll look for a motion. Dana?
Before I make a motion, do we want to have a public comment or anything on this?
Thank you. Yeah, we should have a public comment on this. We've had our staff report, and yeah, we'll open this up now to public comment. If there is anyone, thank you for that, Dana. If there's anyone in the public that would like to comment on this particular item, please come up now. All right. Seeing no one for public comment, we'll close public comment, and we will now take board comment. Thanks, Dana.
Well, I would like to make a motion that we recommend to the City Council consideration to change Harbor Department rules and regulations that would allow for commercial fishermen with more than one qualified vessel to keep either vessel in their slip without having to sublease or pay transient fees for the second vessel.
Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second that.
All right. Moved by Dana, seconded by Jim. Any discussion? All right. No discussion.
No.
Then I'll call a vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? It passes unanimously. Thank you. Thanks, guys. We'll move on to the, that concludes unfinished business. We'll move on to new business, item D1, the proposed change of Harbor Advisory Board bylaws to allow for designated Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association seat to have an alternate member or members in order to ensure association attendance and participation. And we'll go back over to Eric for the staff report and input on this item.
Yeah, thank you again. So another return item that's been batted around a little bit over the last few months. As you know, our commercial fishing organization seat has been empty for a while since Brett Cunningham stepped down and returned to the sea. We've since had Tom Hafer speak from the Commercial Fishermen's Organization expressing interest on being on the Harbor Advisory Board to fill that seat, but was a little worried about being able to fulfill the attendance requirements based on his fishing habits and having to actually go out and make a living. So I think even prior to him stepping forward, we've had interest in is there a possibility of changing the Harbor Advisory Board bylaws to allow for a multiple person sitting on that seat or an alternate or some combination thereof. So at the I think at the September 5th Harbor Advisory Board meeting, that's when Tom Hafer came and spoke, and I think we set it as a future agenda item. So I drafted up again with my best
seat, the fishing industry seat, and the language would read such as this. However, the City Council and Harbor Advisory Board recognize the importance of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association seat and acknowledge that it is often difficult for commercial fishermen serving the Harbor Advisory Board to meet the attendance requirements due to the nature of their business. As such, up to two alternate MBCFO members to the primary member may be appointed by the City Council in the same manner and fashion as regular appointments in order to stand in for the primary member in the event of the primary member's absence. So for some of our viewers at home, our fishermen are gone quite a bit when they're doing their job and working out on their boats, and they can't be here at every meeting. So this would allow for that seat to rotate up to two additional alternates. Any other questions, comments?
So as I see it, this would be continue. This would begin, this language would begin right after, on our first page, it has appointment, it has two members at large, it has a list of members, and then right under that would start this language, however the City Council is, I'm correct?
That's correct,
right.
Dana.
Yeah.
That's seemed the most logical place for it to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? Yes, Gene?
Do we want to limit this to two additional members, or is it, we want to leave it open for the for Tom or somebody to make a decision of more than two other additional persons?
In the staff report, it's being recommended that there be two additional. Eric, do you have...
three persons.
Yeah, so it would be three people rotating total. Do you have any insight for us on how you came up with the total of three people, one and two alternates?
There was no magic to it. I didn't pull it out of any kind of hat or come up with any kind of a model. Two seemed reasonable.
One, obviously, you kind of fall into the same category. I hesitated to have it as just a open slate in that, you know, the Harbor Advisory Board appointments are City Council approved, and it's, you know, goes through that process. So I didn't want to put too many on there, one, because of that, and two, because I didn't want to load down that process as well with, you know, five different potential, you know, folks that may be looking at one seat.
Yeah, I like the number two. One doesn't seem like enough. Three seems like too many as far as the alternates, and two seems just right, just like the,
I agree.
The three little bears. Lynn, did you have anything else?
I think that that's an appropriate number, and it's long overdue that we do this.
Jim?
I'm curious, just from the standpoint of how this would work with the City Council when it does interview the potential candidates for the position on the Harbor Advisory Board in January. Would they, at that point, not only approve the person on the board, but also the two alternates? Would they have to have those names, in other words, to approve them at that time?
Yes, that's how I would see it. And obviously, there's a little devil in the details on how this works. The way I would envision it, there would be a primary person, because you know, if possible, you want the consistency in the same person. So the council, in my view, would vote on a primary, and then others that have applied, you know, through the CFO, I'm assuming the Fishermen's Organization is going to work amongst themselves as well and come up with their folks that and encourage them to attend. Then the council would assign, you know, if five folks showed up for two extra seats, then they'd make a decision on, you know, two out of five instead of, you know, one.
Well, that's what I would think would have to happen, too, because the alternates would have to be kept abreast of the issues, the minutes, and that sort of stuff, as well as the primary person. So I'd have to know who they are in advance.
Yeah, you'd want designated folks instead of just having an open two alternates, whoever Tom can find. If it ends up being Tom, you wouldn't want that, because you do need some consistency, and they need to talk, because if the primary guy can't come or primary gal can't come, you'd hope that they can at least brief, you know, their alternate members on what's been going on.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
I could see how, you know, maybe you could have some problems, but actually I think this will work real well. You know, that it's coming from the organization, the association of, I think that they'll come as a group. And I think it'll work out well, so I'm all for it the way it is.
All right. Yes, Jim.
I would imagine that all of the members of the commercial fishing organization, not all of them at least, are residents of Morro Bay. Would the alternates have to be residents of Morro Bay as well as members of the commercial fishing organization?
To a change to the Harbor Advisory Board bylaws that would allow for alternates to the Morro Bay Commercial Fisheries Association designated seat in order to facilitate full and complete participation of the MBCFO in Harbor Advisory Board proceedings.
So before I seek a second on that motion, would you like to phrase that motion that mentions specifically the two alternates, the number two alternates? Your motion, of course, is open to a second at any time, but I would like to see you put in that motion the specific number of two alternates.
I'm good with that.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Lynn. Any discussion? All right, so I'm going to have you restate that motion once more, Dana, with including somehow in the language in there the specific number of two alternates. So there's your challenge for the night.
Okay, as I reread this, it would be recommend to the City Council consideration of a change to the Harbor Advisory Board bylaws that would allow for two alternates to the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association designated seat in order to facilitate full and complete participation of the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Association in Harbor Advisory Board proceedings.
Excellent. Thank you. That's a good restatement. So, again, any further discussion? Seeing none, and we've had a restatement of the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion carries unanimously. Thank you very much. Good job, guys and gals. That concludes new business. We now move on to item E on the agenda, declaration of future agenda items. Are there any future agenda items from the board members? We got a lot cleared out tonight, I'll tell you. Dana.
Not necessarily for the next meeting, but I think maybe it's been a while since we heard from Rick Algert. His name was thrown around a few times tonight. Maybe he could give us a report on his...
On the whole quota fund?
Quota fund, yeah.
Okay. The things I have on my running list, just so we never forget or don't forget that I try to squeeze on and get moving on, is a state park marine operating agreement, and do we stay in it? What's the status? It's just been kind of laying fallow there, so that's on my radar screen. Friends of the Harbor Department, that's waiting for a report from our committee, see if we have any friends. The planning process for the power plant, I think, was brought up, you know, the new futures group, you know, what's the future of the power plant? Just general discussion of that, a report on the Clean Marina program and how it works, more of a just discussion item, and how we get certified and remain certified in general matters there. And then John Greaser from the CCSMA, like you say, has expressed interest to come back, so if you'd like to hear him again in the future, he may be a good one to tie to Rick. Tie them at the hip since they work together and report on both at the same time.
So, board members, you just heard that list that Eric read off. There's one in particular that stands out to me, but as far as wanting to have one sooner than the others, how about from the board members, is there anything that Eric just read that you would prefer to have sooner than later that appears to be more urgent to you? Well, the one I'm thinking of is the Marina Operating Agreement. I mean, I would love to see that one sooner as opposed to later. And the others, Eric, I think they're all out there, and whenever, you know, at your discretion, whenever the stars align for those.
Friends of the Harbor.
Yeah, that's Bill. Bill is that's Bill is spearheading that one. Yes, Jim.
We have had on the agenda in the past a report from Associated Pacifics on their maintenance schedule or intended maintenance schedule, and I think there's a number of people in the State Park Marina would like to have that presentation at some point in time, so I'd like to see that happen if it can.
We did have that a few months ago. I had to put it off a couple meetings because Paul Gillen was carried away for other business. We had it on the agenda ready to go, and I think I ended up just pinch hitting for him and stepping in, but it wasn't, you know, the full report that they've had. I'll check with Paul and see where they're at on, because that was a while ago now, earlier in the summer maybe, or midsummer. So I'll see what the where he's at on his schedule, because they do that annually. I'll see if he's come and suggest if we pull the State Park Marina agreement, the operating agreement, do an assessment of that and see where we're at and in terms of state parks, and if we meet with state parks between now and then and bring the State Park Marina maintenance plan, maybe that's have a State Park Marina night.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that sounds good. Yeah, and I think I've heard the expressed desire several times now over several months. We would just like to get a representative from AP to one of our meetings. I think that's probably the bottom line.
Okay, and we can add to that. Our dredging, you know, we've pretty much closed out all our final documentation on our environmental reporting on that, so I could maybe wrap up a good summary of that, of how that all worked, and maybe what our future steps on that are.
That'd be great. Anything else from you, Eric, with regard to future agenda items?
Nope, I don't have anything else hanging.
Yep, thank you for keeping track of those items. Anything else from board members regarding future agenda items?
If at some time we could hear if there's been any progress on getting the liveaboards in the harbor to all be have their permits, liveaboard permits?
Yeah, we've done that in the past, liveaboard status update. I can do that. I can just give a quick hint. We do have pretty darn good compliance right now, but I might drag my patrol supervisor, Beck under the bus with me on that one and have her come and report on it. But we can do that.
Thank you.
Anything else? Drag them under the bus or under the keel?
Keel, I guess.
Keel hauler.
Yeah, I do have a comment. Last week when we had all the wind storm, one of the boats broke loose in the moorings. And winter is coming. Sometimes we get some really bad storms, October, November. I would just emphasize that you've got a boat out there on a mooring. Get your chafing gear on the boat and make sure you got good lines, more than one. So.
Yep. We are coming up to that time of year.
Professional.
Yep. All right. We'll now look for a motion to adjourn.
I so move.
I so
moved by Bill, seconded, I'm sorry, moved by Jim, seconded by Gene. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Meeting is adjourned. Thank you.